It's good to be with you again, friends at Buninyong Anglican Church, and anyone else who's watching. I'm really pleased to be here. It's been said that we live in an attention economy, and that right now the most valuable commodity is attention, your attention and my attention. This really brought home to me earlier on this year when we sat down with our kids to watch Lego Masters for the first time. They absolutely loved it. But all through every episode, they kept moaning roughly every 5 to 10 minutes, as if on cue. Why? Because of the ads. We actually have to educate our kids about commercial TV. You see, they've grown up with streaming, with ABC iView and Netflix and Disney Plus since the start of the first lockdown. But here they were, finding their viewing continually interrupted by these loud, repetitive ads, making bids for their attention. And so we had to teach them about the fact that while they were watching Lego Masters for free, it actually costs money to make. And the way the company makes money to pay for a show like that is by selling our attention to advertisers. You know, they get our eyeballs glued to the screens, they grab our attention, then they monetize it by selling it to companies who advertise their products and services to us. But it's not just advertising that tries to get people's attention, is it? We all do it. We're all trying to get each other's attention all the time, aren't we? Social media is pretty much built on this fact and then monetized in exactly the same way as commercial TV, you know, ads in front of our eyeballs as we endlessly scroll as we and compete to get each other's attention. We also kind of feel like, we kind of like the feeling, don't we, of people paying attention to us, being noticed, being seen, you know, as long as what they're seeing is good and impressive, or in our more altruistic moments, as long as it advances, say, a worthy cause. The result of all this, though, is that we end up in the middle of a kind of constant competition for attention. And there's sometimes an even darker side to this attention economy. The actor, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he actually argues that giving in to the urge to try and get attention from others actually hurts us more than we realise. In particular, he says it kills our creativity, which is important for him as an actor, right? Because that usually requires us to give our attention to something or someone else in a sustained sort of way. And so by constantly trying to get attention, we actually damage our ability to give our attention to others. This is what he says. I've got a quote. He says, "In my experience, the more I go after the powerful feeling of paying attention, the happier I am. But the more I go after the powerful feeling of getting attention, the unhappier I am." Gordon-Levitt gives an example from his profession as an actor. He says, "I'd be sitting there reading a script, and instead of thinking, how can I personally identify with this character, or how is the audience going to relate to this story? I'm like, what are people going to say about this movie on Twitter? And what will I say back that will be good and snarky enough to get a lot of retweets, but not too harsh, because people love to get offended, and I don't want to get cancelled? These are the thoughts that enter my mind when I'm supposed to be reading a script, trying to be an artist," he says. And I wonder if you've experienced anything like that. Maybe it's happened to you in the workplace, where the desire to be noticed and have your contributions sort of seen and given due attention and credit, maybe that sabotages your ability to work with others, you know, to praise them for the things they're doing. It can even happen among a group of friends. It did happen with me and my friends when I was back at Bible college. It was like, kind of without discussing it, we'd all agreed we had this kind of implicit competition where we each tried to outdo one another in making jokes or snappy comebacks. And as a result, all that conversation stayed at surface level. But I distinctly remember one day when I was walking along with some friends and I realized that one of them wasn't doing so well, and I had to kind of face this moment of decision. Was I just going to plunge on with the competition to kind of have the best zinging line? Or was I going to slow down, pause, and give my attention to my friend? It's obvious, isn't it, which course of action makes for the other person good, which one is more loving in the terms of the passage we're reading this morning, because love is the ultimate form of giving your attention to someone. But even when we want to give our best attention to someone, to connect with the members of our household or friends, or show love to a significant other or whatever it is, we keep finding ourselves trying to get attention, to get enough likes and comments and retweets, to get a response to that devastatingly good joke, to get seen and noticed and appreciated. And it strikes at the heart of our ability to give attention and to love. And that's why we need to hear what Paul says here in 1 Corinthians 13 this morning. Because what Paul says here helps us navigate the choppy waters of the attention economy. It can help us give up on constantly trying to get attention so that we can give our attention to others instead. We're going to delve into this treasure chest of a passage here, considering first of all what Paul says love isn't, then what love is, and finally why it's worth pursuing the way of love, which he calls the still more excellent way. So first, what love is, we see it there in verses 1 to 3 of 1 Corinthians 13. Paul begins by saying what love isn't. And it's just crucially important for helping us to distinguish between the genuine artifact and counterfeits. I learned this week that the Reserve Bank issues instructions about how to recognize counterfeit banknotes so that we know we have the real thing. And here in 1 Corinthians 13 verses 1 to 3, Paul gives us a masterclass in distinguishing between genuine love and counterfeit versions. Have a read with me. Paul says, "If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I'm nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing." Now, this is crucially important in Paul's context. You may remember that the church in Corinth had some issues with how they treated one another in their pursuit of kind of being impressive and exercising impressive gifts and showing the world that the church was just great, full of God's power. They were treating each other pretty poorly. They were making people who didn't have kind of miraculous gifts, who couldn't speak in tongues of men or of angels, they were making these people feel less than. And so, crucially, Paul points out that here, love is the missing ingredient. That even with the most impressive, miraculous abilities, the most impressive self-sacrificial actions, if they lack love, then they're hollow, they're nothing, Paul says. And just quietly, I'm a bit of an expert on these kind of hollow self-sacrificial actions. A therapist I once spoke with observed that I tended to be what he called a silent martyr. You know, I would constantly sacrifice and put myself out and put aside my needs and not mention it because I'm, you know, important as a firstborn child. I'm not going to mention it. I'm not going to toot my own horn. I'm just going to lay aside my wand. But I always am hoping that others will notice, that they'll applaud me, that they'll recognize me, that I'll get their attention for sacrificing my wants. And I get resentful when they don't notice. I'm silent, but I'm a martyr. I've got this passive-aggressive thing going on. And during the Protestant Reformation in Europe 500 years ago, Martin Luther saw this same dynamic at play, and he spoke about it clearly. You see, Luther wanted to uphold the glorious, liberating reality that salvation in Christ is a free gift. It's not earned or merited by the things we do. We don't get attention from God. We don't need to do that. Instead, he graciously, generously, in his kindness and free initiative, out of his love, He turns towards us in Jesus. He gives us his attention. Now, Luther's opponents said that if you go around saying that there's nothing we can do to earn or contribute to our standing with God, they said, then you remove any incentive for people to do good or pay attention to others. But Luther's comeback was brilliant and full of insight. He said, if you do good things for others, even for God, with one eye always on how that will bump up your standing and favour you, will you actually hollow out your good actions? Right when you're trying to be focused on other people and their good, you're secretly, or not so secretly, keeping an eye on your own good. You are, Luther said, becoming turned in on yourself. And that's actually the essence of sin, self-centeredness. Now, infecting every good and other person-centered thing you do. And that very much reflects what Paul's getting at here. Right? How even the greatest act of self-sacrifice, giving away all your possessions, handing your body over so I may boast, or some translations have, to the flames, laying down your life for other people with an eye on your own benefit, without love, without giving attention, just trying to get it, that gains you nothing. That's what love isn't. In the next verses, Paul goes on to say what love is, in contrast. And so let's read it, verses 4 to 7. He said, love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. It should go without saying, I guess, that love here for Paul is far more than a feeling we might find ourselves falling into or out of. In some ways, it's more like a skill you learn by practice. But it's also worth noting that love here is not something that's kind of offered through gritted teeth, even if it does endure all things, as Paul says, bear all things. And this is really where giving attention comes into its own, in this definition of love, positively. You see, this positive vision, patient, kind, not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude, this picture of love is all about giving your attention to others. I mean, take patience, for example. I've been learning a little bit about patience during lockdown, both as I've been trying to cultivate it in my own life and heart, and as I've observed other members of my family, in the wild, learning about it. Safe to say there've been a few hits and misses. But patience is not sitting on your hands while you wait for your turn to speak. It's not even listening to the other person just for the purpose of proving them wrong or having the comeback. It's actually an exercise in removing yourself from the center. You give your attention to someone else, not passive-aggressively like I kind of do, but confident that something better is going to emerge from the two of you together than if it was just me alone. One writer calls this positive vision of love here in 1 Corinthians 13 a vision of co-agency. Now, it's not just me as an agent, the actor, the one on the main stage with all the plans and significant actions, and the other person is kind of a prop at best or an obstacle at worst. But nor is it me disappearing, leaving the stage so the other person can take center stage. No, love here, this positive definition is a beautiful harmony in which two of us work out something bigger than either one of us, with neither self at the center, but neither self squeezed out of the picture either. Don't you want to experience relationships like this when you've had a taste of patient, kind, not envious or boastful, not irritable or resentful, not insisting on its own way kind of love? Isn't it glorious? Wouldn't it be beautiful in the church at Buninyong that that's how you related to each other? In your relationships, in your homes, And so we come then to verses 8 to 13. This is the third shining jewel in this passage, where Paul tells us why love is worth pursuing, although hopefully you've already seen, as Paul's defined it negatively and positively, that this is worth having. Let's read it, verses 8 to 13. Paul says, love never ends, but as for prophecies, they'll come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end, for we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we'll see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I'll know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. And the greatest of these is love. Now, the basic message here is clear, isn't it? Love is worth pursuing because it lasts. It endures. It's the thing that, the greatest thing, one of the things that remains, one of the things that belongs, actually, has its home in the new creation, God's glorious future. It's a taste of heaven, if you like, a foretaste of glory that we get to experience now, ahead of time, taking effect in us. For the last several years, my parents have been giving my brother and me what they call an AOYI, an advance on your inheritance. Now, you know, you may want to argue with them about the specifics of how they've planned out their finances, but what that does for us is it means now, ahead of time, we get to begin to experience the sort of financial freedom and stability that my parents want for us and want to contribute to and leave to us as their lasting legacy. And it's the same here with love. Love is, as I say, that foretaste of glory, taking effect now. The great American theologian Jonathan Edwards says that all our problems in life actually come from getting love wrong, from love being out of proportion. He says we're meant to love small things a small amount, medium things a medium amount, big things a big amount, and God most of all. You need a theologian to tell you that kind of thing, right? But he says heaven or glory, the new creation, will be where we love all things in the right order, and so that we're free to enjoy them as we should and not get ourselves kind of scrambled, loving things the wrong amount, you know, loving small things a big amount. Because actually, all our problems come from getting this mixed up, right? Well, ultimately, we love getting attention. We love that feeling we get, which is a good feeling, but not the greatest feeling. And we love it, it's a little thing, and we love it a medium or perhaps a big amount even, and certainly more than giving our attention to others. And that keeps tripping us up. You know, we struggle to displace ourselves from the center of the universe, to exit center stage, and we can only do it, actually, by making God the center of our personal moral universes. And we can only do that insofar as we embrace the fact that the living, personal center of the universe, the God who in all eternity is love, that's the definition of God biblically, God is love, that this God, in his great love, took the initiative to come to us, to be with us, as one of us, God in the flesh, God with skin on, the love that set the universe into being, walking among us. And instead of loving him, we pushed him aside. We pushed him off the stage. We crucified him outside the city gates. And he endured that. He bore it with perfect patience and kindness, without envy or boasting or arrogance or rudeness. He didn't insist on his own way. He wasn't irritable or resentful. He rejoiced only in the truth. and he did it for you and for me. And to the degree that gets into your heart, it can rearrange and reorder your loves. It can teach you to resist counterfeit versions of love in which we put ourselves at the center. We keep trying to get attention. And it can free us to pursue genuine love so that we get to experience ahead of time in our lives, now our relationships, now that perfectly ordered, delightful life of glory, a taste of heaven as we give our attention to others. Loving small things a small amount, medium things a medium amount, big things a big amount, and God most of all. Do you want that, sisters and brothers at Buninyong Anglican Church? Because I want it. I want it for me and I want it for you, and I'm going to pray that God does that work in us, in his great love for us. Let's pray. Our gracious God, we thank you that you're a God of love. We thank you that you give us yourself in your love, not grudgingly, not through gritted teeth, but freely and generously, patiently and kindly. We pray that that would get a grip on our hearts, that it might free us from that just so hurtful desire to constantly get attention and be at the center, that we too might learn the skill, the habits, and experience the joy of giving our attention to others in